What 3 million new files are telling us about the Epstein case? What a suit's telling us about Miami's signature bridge? And what Bad Bunny's telling us about Puerto Rico? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk to the Miami Herald journalist who's done the most to keep the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case alive. How does she assess the massive new release of files? We'll also look at disturbing complaints of alleged design errors and defective materials as Miami's once celebrated Fountain Bridge project faces even more delays and costs. And we'll discuss the trials and triumphs of Puerto Rico that Bad Bunny was singing about at the Super Bowl. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. In the past 2 weeks, the Department of Justice has released more than 3 million more pages of files related to the sex trafficking case of the late millionaire financier Jeffrey Epstein. Those documents are casting a broader spotlight on a host of powerful men in the U.S. and abroad who, it turns out, despite their earlier denials, did have ties to Epstein when he was carrying out the sexual abuse of dozens of girls 2 decades ago. President Trump has long insisted he did not know about Epstein's crimes in the days when they had a close friendship, but one new document indicates Trump did know. The Epstein case might be focused on Washington today, but the pain of its victims is felt here in South Florida, especially Palm Beach County, where Epstein resided. No journalist has done more important coverage than the Miami Herald's Julie K. Brown. WLRN's Carlton Gillespie spoke with her yesterday.
Julie, thanks for being with us. In your estimation, how explosive are these millions of newly released documents, and why do you think the Trump administration released them?
Well, first of all, they had to release them because Congress passed a law in December, I believe it was, which was pushed by the victims. To their credit, they were the ones that raised awareness and have mobilized to force the DOJ to release these documents. So they were very successful in lobbying members of Congress to vote for this law. And I think Trump had to sign it because they would have been able to override his veto anyway. So that's why they released it, because of pressure, not only by the victims, but I think by the general public that believes that this is a cover-up and that the DOJ hasn't handled this as openly as they should.
How explosive was this new batch of documents?
I think it's very explosive to people who haven't followed the case like I have. Mm-hmm. I've known that this was a huge sex trafficking and, by the way, money laundering operation that he was running with people from all over the world. And so I sort of feel a little vindicated because I think there have been a lot of people out there, including, by the way, in the media, who have minimized this story. And so this is huge to people that really have never really known or followed this case to understand how evil and how much he had a hold on so many important people in our country.
Yeah. And one of the documents of this new batch is one that you were kind of the first to pick up on this one in particular. It would seem to prove that President Trump did, in fact, know about Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking of girls in New York and Palm Beach in the 1990s and the early 2000s. It involves a phone call that Trump apparently made in 2006 to then Palm Beach Police Chief Michael Ryder. Tell us about that and what it likely means to this case and the president's involvement in it.
Well, first, let me put the whole thing in context. This document was an FBI interview with Chief Ryder in 2019 after Epstein's arrest. But the interview concerned the investigation that Ryder did way back in 2006. Mm-hmm. In any event, the FBI came to pick up some boxes, you know, because the Palm Beach Police Department had run the investigation. There was some material they wanted. And at the time, they decided that they would interview the police chief to find out if he had any other information. Again, this is 2019. And the chief described the whole investigation. By the way, this interview, I just found out actually yesterday, was a sworn interview. He took an oath. So everything in here was with him under oath. Mm-hmm. And he was asked questions by the FBI agents, you know, like, was there anything else that you found out, or is there anyone else that came forward with information? And the chief said, yes, Donald Trump came forward in 2006, and he said, you know, everybody knew, I'm not quoting exactly, I don't have it in front of me, but everybody, thank God you stopped him. And everybody knew about this. Now, the reason he said, thank God you stopped him, was because when he called the chief, Epstein had been arrested. Mm-hmm. In other words, the police investigation was pretty much done and they had already filed charges. So, you know, it made the media, and Trump had called him and said, thank God you're stopping him. Everybody knew. And then he further said, you have to look at Maxwell. She's evil. And although Ryder didn't use the word operative, basically what the FBI wrote down was that she was somehow really high in this hierarchy of people involved in this sex trafficking operation. He called him when Epstein was arrested, not like he was an informant that gave him information beforehand.
Right. Right. I mean, this is a national, international story, really. But like you mentioned, it started in Palm Beach County. How did Florida, and South Florida in particular, set the scene for Epstein's crimes to be covered up for so long, but also for his controversially lenient prosecution here? Just before these newest Epstein documents were released, you had fresh reporting on what you call the charm offensive that his lawyers pushed on prosecutors here.
Right. I actually think that this is an important, very important part of this story that sometimes gets overlooked with, you know, the search for the list and all these famous people. And, you know, that's important, too, to know who these people were that were involved or at least associated with Epstein, because it says something about the kind of people they are. But I do focus a lot on the deal in Florida that was made for the very important reason that had prosecutors done their job way back in 2007, then he would have been in prison. We wouldn't be sitting here.
Right.
But they let him off the hook in the most inexplicable way, because they not only gave him a plea bargain, and he actually served 13 months. The sentence was longer, but he got out after 13 months. But the even more damaging part of this deal was, part of the terms of this deal was that they had to keep it secret.
Mm-hmm.
So when Epstein went to court to plead guilty, and he was pleading guilty in state court, not in federal court, he got federal immunity, and he pled to these two solicitation charges in Palm Beach County. But we didn't know that. Nobody knew that until Epstein went to jail, served his time, and got out, because what happened was they sealed it. So lawyers went to court, and it took them almost a year to unseal that deal. Now, why did they keep it secret? Why do you think? They kept it secret because they didn't want the public to know that they were letting a very wealthy, powerful man off the hook for essentially raping and molesting dozens of girls. And it's, people should be angry at that. And that, I don't think that that's all been adequately investigated.
What else? I mean, this is, you're talking about the prosecution done by the U.S. Attorney of Miami, Alex Acosta,
that's
and
right.
the Palm Beach State Attorney's Office.
Right.
What is it that's yet to be explained, or who's yet to be held accountable for how that happened?
Well, let me tell you something else we're seeing in these documents that are coming out. As you can imagine, I'm zeroing in on that early deal to find out if there's any clues. And one thing that I am seeing is, one of the architects of that deal is a man named Matthew Menchel. He was the assistant U.S. attorney for the criminal division under Acosta, and he helped write portions of that deal. And then he went off and got a job in private practice. Matthew Menchel has met with Epstein over the years after this was done. We can track it back to 2010, which is essentially the year that his sentence was over.
Right.
So as soon as he fulfilled his sentence, he was meeting with one of the U.S. attorneys who made that deal. So what we've also been able to see in some of these documents is that Epstein tried to buy almost everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that's what happened in Menchel's case, but, you know, you see how he just, let's hire him. These were people who were in government. These were people who worked for us as taxpayers. And he offered or tried to offer everyone some kind of a deal, like, or a job, come work for me, that kind of thing. So we don't know exactly what happened here in Florida, but it's just from the beginning, it never made sense. So it's something that I am really looking into, because I don't want people to forget the fact that had this not happened in South Florida, which was the first real failure, not only we wouldn't be here, but there would have been far less victims, because he continued to really victimize young girls and women after this deal happened.
Yeah. I mean, you also mentioned this week on your Substack that Pam Bondi, the U.S. Attorney General, she, quote, dropped the ball on the Epstein case when she was the Attorney General of Florida from 2011 to 2019. How did she drop the ball?
Well, as the Attorney General here in Florida, she is the state's prosecutor. And this case, after the deal was done, all these victims came forward because they found out then, because remember, it was sealed. So they came forward and they said, wait a minute, how does this happen? And they hired lawyers and they filed a federal lawsuit against the government and they tried to overturn that deal. And a lot of other victims, I think I counted something like 23 other lawsuits were filed by victims against Epstein. And a lot of these lawsuits became public. So everybody in Florida pretty much knew that this was, you know, there were all these headlines in the newspapers saying that he was raping girls. And I don't know if you remember, but when Pam Bondi came into office here in Florida as the Attorney General, she sort of made sex trafficking her mission. You know, she was going to go after sex traffickers and human traffickers and formed panels. And doesn't it seem kind of strange that the highest profile sex trafficker in Florida history, at the very least, she's not asking questions like, we better go back into this and take a new look? I mean, she is the chief law enforcement officer in Florida. She certainly had the power to say, wait a minute, something doesn't sound right here. All these new victims have come forward. What can we do to get justice for these victims?
And there have been complaints in recent days from Democrats, but also from some Republicans in Congress, that there are too many redactions or information blacked out in these new documents. Is that a concern you share as a journalist looking into this as well? And if it is, how do you think the Trump administration should rectify it?
Well, here's the other thing. They delayed really releasing all these files in part because they said they wanted to make sure that they would redact all the names of the victims to protect their identities.
Right.
And in fact, what they did, it seems, was to protect the identities of some of the people who associated with Epstein, particularly male people who were very powerful. And meanwhile, there were countless examples of victims' names who were, you know, not redacted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had one job to do, and that was to protect the victims, and they didn't do that. And the victims are re-traumatized by all this, and also suspect that this was done on purpose to sort of send a message to intimidate them to be quiet. You know, you just should sit down and be quiet and not say anything. Otherwise, we're going to out you. I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's how the victims feel.
Right. I mean, regarding those victims, what is your sense to how hopeful or pessimistic they are now that justice in this case might be closer with the release of more files?
All these victims have different stories to tell, and they're all different with what they've been through. And so it's hard to just make one broad statement about whether they feel that they will ever receive justice. I'm sure some of them are very hopeful still. Some of them are completely just discouraged. Some of them will never come forward because they see what's happening already, so they'll never say anything. It's a range of emotions, you know, and it's in the news every single day. Can you imagine this story, which you probably spent part of your life trying to forget, being the top headline on every news station, radio station, podcast in the world, really. And so they can't even get away from it. But I have to give them a lot of credit because they've mobilized like they never have before. I've been on this story since 2016, and it was hard to get me to talk, to get them to talk, to get them to unburden themselves with this. And so we've come a long way in that now they're a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. I mean, part of that motivation comes from the connection with President Trump. President Trump's own South Florida base, Mar-a-Lago, was once in Epstein's stomping ground. In your view, how deep is the political trouble attached to this controversy getting for the president the more these files come out?
I think it's not the more the files come out. I think it's the more they hide things.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what the public is really focusing on. Like, if you're hiding things and you see all these redactions, it makes the public more and more distrustful of the DOJ and the Trump administration. I think Pam Bondi's performance in front of the House Judiciary Committee was really disgraceful. All those victims were in that room, only steps from her. And the way that she behaved, first of all, she didn't answer any questions. And these were victims that have these questions. You know, she wanted to attack the lawmakers, especially Democratic lawmakers. But if you're focused only on attacking, then I think it was really disrespectful of the fact that the victims really do want these questions asked. Whether you don't like the person asking it has nothing to do with it. These are solid questions, you know, and I think that she did not do herself any good by the way that she handled that. I've never seen, you know, I've been a journalist for over 40 years, and I don't remember ever seeing a U.S. attorney general behave like that in front of Congress.
I mean, that committee this week also saw Epstein's convicted co-conspirator Ghislaine Maxwell via Zoom brought in front of them from prison. She refused to answer questions, invoking her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, but she did indicate that she might give testimony in exchange for clemency. How important do you think her input is at this point?
Look, here's one thing to keep in mind. She knows everything. She does. We've never seen her emails. She's probably saved things. She knows where all the bodies are buried, so to speak. And I'm sure that there are a lot of very high-profile people in this country who are worried about what she may say if she isn't given clemency. So I really do think that she's holding the cards and she's trying to wait and see and wait it out until maybe Trump is almost out of office and hope that he gives her a pardon. She absolutely knows everything. And her, quite frankly, even if she would testify, she's perjured herself already.
Right.
So her testimony, you have to take it with a grain of salt, really.
Yeah. Julie, I also just wanted to ask you your personal sense of how important it is, not just to Epstein's victim, but to the whole country, that this case does move forward to a just resolution.
Well, it is important, and here's why. Our government, you know, our whole sense of who we are is based on how we treat people who live in our country. And there is no one that we should protect more than children. And I think what gets lost in this sometimes is these were children. At least when it started, he was, and I'm sure he continued this because he really was a pedophile. And so he had an obsession and he went after children. And in this case, it almost, I think the public feels that we are, as a country, aren't in a government, aren't addressing this horrific crime. And if we ignore this crime, which affected so many children, what does that say about us?
Well, Julie, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was WLRN's Carlton Gillespie speaking with the Miami Herald's Julie K. Brown about the latest developments in the Jeffrey Epstein case. Still to come, is Miami's signature bridge now a bridge of broken dreams? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. When it was first announced almost a decade ago, the massive facelift for the highway interchange joining I-95, the Dolphin Expressway, and I-395 promised to be a glorious project for downtown Miami. Its central bridge structure, called the Fountain after the water spout-like arches towering overhead, would be the I-395 signature overpass. Well, Anyone who commutes downtown has surely noticed the overpass is way over schedule and way over budget. It was supposed to be finished in 2021, but now make that 2029. Maybe. Some of the reasons are understandable, like supply chain disruption caused by the pandemic, but something much less excusable is now alleged in a lawsuit. Those bridge archers weren't designed to withstand the sort of hurricane winds Miami might face, and the concrete used to build them was defective. And fixing these errors may have added more than $400 million to the project's cost. Worse, a few weeks ago, six workers at the site were seriously injured, further halting construction. Joining me now are Hatzel Vela and Tony Pipitone. They are the local NBC6 Investigates journalists who last week reported on this litigation and the Miami Interchange Project dysfunction. How are you guys?
Great. Good to be here, Tim.
Good, Tim. Thanks for having us.
And let us know your thoughts about Miami's signature bridge problems. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Hatzel Vela, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. I think we should start by saying our thoughts are with those six hospitalized workers. Do we know their current conditions?
You know, at last time we checked, we did not know their current condition. And in fact, we're still trying to figure out what's going on with that case, which is separate from our investigation. But certainly our thoughts are with the families. And it's certainly not easy for them.
Oh, no. Well, as we mentioned, Hatzel, the I-395 Signature Bridge was originally supposed to be finished 5 years ago, but here are some of the observations of downtown Miami drivers that NBC6 gathered for your report as they tried to navigate this seemingly endless road construction mess.
It's horrible.
It's a mess.
Hour and 30 every day.
What I had to do was get off of the highway to get back on to avoid at least 100 cars.
So, Hatzel, there are so many players in this Miami muddle. So let's start with who conceived this project back in 2017 and who are now taking the heat for what's gone wrong. What was their vision of this and how much was it going to cost, I mean, originally?
So, Tim, thanks for having us once again on your show. First, I have to say it's been amazing to collaborate with the great Tony Pipitone on this project.
I can imagine.
So let's get right to it, right? So we know that the Florida Department of Transportation and its partner, the Greater Miami Expressway Authority, are overseeing this project. As you mentioned, it was supposed to be done by 2021 and cost, get this, $802 million, right? Not cheap.
Right.
Now FDOT says the project may be done in 2029, as you mentioned, and the price tag, no surprise, is much higher, according to the lawsuits filed by the main contractor.
But what was this project supposed to accomplish for us here in terms of, as I said, this facelift for this massive interchange here in downtown Miami and these glorious arches over the bridge? What was the vision here?
It was supposed to change the face of Miami, right? Miami's always all about being fancy and showing off. The skyline was going to change, but most importantly, let's be real here. It was supposed to ease the traffic flow in a very complicated area. If you've driven in that part of downtown Miami, you know it's not easy to get around. It was supposed to alleviate traffic. It was supposed to get people faster to the beach. A lot of things that people have been wanting for decades if you grew up and know South Florida.
Right. Tony Pipitone, you mentioned yourself right now, traffic flow, but remind us who won the contract to make this dream a reality and who they then hired to design that dream.
Well, it was really a controversial bidding process. Archer Western Des Moines joint venture eventually won out, and they hired a company called HDR Engineering to do the engineering of the bridge portion,
which
of the
is
project.
Out of Nebraska, right?
Yeah, okay. And it's one portion of the project is the bridge project, but it was controversial because another company that did not get it, MCM Construction, who was combined with Fig Engineering. And if that sounds familiar, Fig Bridge and MCM were involved in the FIU Bridge, which collapsed.
Thanks
so they had protested this bid, and that held it up for over a year at the beginning as the protests went on. But then, of course, on March 15th, 2018, you saw what happened out at FIU. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Fig and MCM dropped their protest.
Mm-hmm. So, Hatzel, as we mentioned, the bridge's original finish date got pushed from 2021 to 2023, then to 2027, and then now to 2029. What reasons has the Florida Department of Transportation been giving during all this time for those delays? I mean, we're looking at almost a decade of delayed here.
And you talk to folks out on the streets, and they'll tell you, what is going on here, right?
Yeah.
What's happening here? Well, they have cited a number of reasons over the years, that including supply chain issues, bad weather, utility relocations, even holidays, right? But not the reasons, Tim, cited in the lawsuits that we found. And that's what makes this story really, truly interesting here.
Yeah. So, Tony, as you and Hatzell and NBC6 Investigates discovered, a lawsuit out there perhaps offers the real or most important reasons. This has so far been a bridge to nowhere. Yeah. Who filed it? Who did they file it against? And what does it allege?
So there were several lawsuits filed by the joint venture, and the one against engineering firm HDR claimed that their initial design of the arches would not have been able to withstand the high winds. Of course, you know, we have something called hurricanes here in South
right.
Florida, so not a good thing. You know, the joint venture claims that this added years of delay and millions of costs, extra costs, design costs, construction costs, supervision, quality control, expert investigation, and attorney's fees.
And let me clarify something. When this was all playing out amongst them, did we, the public, really know anything about this?
No, we had no idea.
Okay.
And that's why I think this is important, that this is the first time we're hearing from the joint venture about what they're blaming the delays on. It's important to point out, though, that the changes were made to the design before construction began. They caught with what the joint venture says was an error. HDR denies it.
Uh-huh.
And the changes were made, but it added concrete, it added more reinforcement steel and more cost.
Right, but again, a central issue here there, though, is that even though they were able to redesign before construction started, the actual construction was delayed as a result of this muddle, right?
Yeah, I think that's undisputed in the litigation. It did cause some delay.
Yeah, and not only delay, but cost. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Hatzell Vela and Tony Pipitone of the local NBC Investigates team about the delays, cost overruns, worker injuries, and now litigation plaguing the massive downtown Miami Interchange Bridge project. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Tony, really quick, I just want to go back to what you and I were just discussing about the, I guess they're calling it the miscalculation of the wind load
yeah.
that these archers could withstand. These were these were supposed to be able to withstand 140 mile per hour winds, right?
Correct.
And the design, they miscalculated that completely?
They say the joint venture alleged that. HDR denies it. They went to a litigation. A judge ruled that whatever it wasn't gross negligence. So that meant that the insurance policy that HDR had was limited to $10 million payout to the joint venture. So they just settled for $10 million plus
okay.
a little more. They settled because they couldn't get above that with
right.
a gross negligence.
And HDR did not have to admit blame.
They, in fact, denied blame.
Right. So, Hatzell, drum roll here. Tell us again how much more the redesign of the bridge arches that HDR then had to do added to the cost of the bridge project.
Drum roll indeed. According to the lawsuit, over $400 million. Interesting. I just had a
So that added 50%. Essentially,
yeah.
then, to and the cost of this
they
project.
They allege,
right, yeah.
They allege, yeah. I had a conversation recently with the mayor of Miami, who you know is really into transportation, and she says, can you imagine the kind of things we could have done with that much money?
Yeah.
It's amazing to see that kind of figure.
But again, as you clarify in your report, it looks like this money won't get dropped on the heads of the taxpayer, though, right?
Well, that's according to one of the lawsuits we reviewed, which explains that the agreement with the Florida Department of Transportation does not allow the contractor to get additional compensation based on errors or omissions in the preliminary design. We still have yet to see what really happens and if they ever get the money, right? Tony, I mean, I don't
yeah.
know if you want to weigh in on that.
Well, one thing is it already went up, right? It was 102 guaranteed maximum, and now it's 802 guaranteed maximum. Now it's $866 million. That may be for work that DOT ordered, or there may be something else. We asked DOT if they received any claims, if they made any settlements, if the potential down the line is that the joint venture is going to sue DOT and maybe taxpayers will be on the hook. And they did not answer those questions.
And so what does HDR, if anything, have to say about this accusation? I guess if nothing, if it's already been settled, this accusation of wind load miscalculation, if it's true, how can a mistake like that occur when you're designing in Miami, of all places?
You know, I'm not an engineer, but I can tell you reading the lawsuits, there were some experts who say there was a mistake. And then HDR had experts who said that, no, you know, they didn't make a mistake.
Okay.
That's how it plays out.
Well, speaking of liability, I just want to pause briefly here to read the statement the Florida Department of Transportation issued in response to your report. Quote, the department was not a party to this lawsuit as it was an internal dispute within their respective team. Managing a full commitment to safety is of the utmost importance for FDOT, and the department continues to work closely with the project's leadership to ensure FDOT's rigorous safety standards remain a top priority throughout the life of the project. But Hatzell, as you and Tony reported, there is another safety standard issue involved in the I-395 Signature Bridge project, according to another lawsuit. This one has to do with defective concrete. Tell us about that added error and how much it has cost this project.
And before I talk about that, Tim, I want to make sure that people in the public realize, as Tony mentioned, we did reach out to the Department of Transportation. We've provided them a list of detailed questions wanting to know what they had answers to and if they had answers to, because we think this is a public safety issue, right?
Right.
We did not get one response, just the generic statement that you read, and they refused to give us an on-camera interview. But when you talk about the other issue, the joint venture said that they lost another $3.6 million because they had to destroy, get this, they had to destroy and replace parts of the bridge because of defective concrete that was not discovered, we learned, through the lawsuit for months. All of this part of that lawsuit, the joint venture filed against one of its insurance companies, trying to recover, of course, the money that they lost, Tim.
Right.
And that concrete was used not necessarily on the bridge, but rather on concrete rebar form structures and other building components as part of the larger project. It took months. It may have taken up to 3 months for them to discover that the concrete would not pass the compression test. Once they did, they had to destroy piers and they had to destroy connections and seams and start over. So they said that added $3.6 million to their costs.
Well, Hatzell, I know it wasn't directly related to these problems we've been discussing up to now, but remind us how the accident occurred last month that so badly injured those six construction workers on the bridge project and what FDOT has had to do in its aftermath.
Yeah, well, we know the incident happened back in January. As you point out, six workers ended up in the hospital. I know they paused some of the project because of it. And then we did get a statement from FDOT saying that it occurred during a scheduled overnight construction operation, which involved construction form work during a concrete pour within the work zone.
Okay.
They go on to say it does not involve the bridge structure or any portion of the roadway open to the traffic.
A lesson learned from FIU.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in just the couple of minutes we have left here, Hatzell, really quickly, watchdogs like Transit Alliance Miami also weighed in on your report. What do they feel this mess says about South Florida's transportation crisis in general? In just 30 seconds here.
Yeah, well, let's not say that they were not surprised about what we found. The organization is totally not a fan of this project since the beginning because they believe simply that we should invest more in alternative ways to get around South Florida instead of relying on
heavy
cars, right?
Uh-huh.
Now that the project is underway, though, they want more transparency and what has caused the delays and whether there should be public confidence in the project. And that's exactly, if I could give a nice cheap plug to our part two, that's exactly where we're going to focus on, public confidence.
We'll look forward to that.
Engineers
right.
about what should have happened here.
And Tony, I want to finish here by congratulating you on your upcoming and richly deserved retirement.
Thank you.
But as a longtime veteran of the Miami scene, how does this debacle involving the I-395 Signature Bridge construction reflect the public project's dysfunction that seems so common to people here in Florida and especially in Miami? As a seasoned journalist here, what lessons are not being learned?
Well, I think we need to be realistic with the public. They need to be realistic with the public, be open to the public and the media when they announce these projects about what it's really going to be like. And this has obviously taken a lot longer and so far cost somewhat more money. We don't know yet what the total will be. Remember, we're the ones who pay the bills, right? We pay the tolls. We pay the gas taxes that the bonds are based on. And for me, after 40 years of covering Florida, one problem I've seen really recently is the lack of public record access for the media. We're doing the work of the public here. You know, most people don't have time to submit public records to us and analyze them. That's what we do. And I've seen in this administration, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles, denying me records, stonewalling me for records that I used to get in a day or two. Yeah. So things are changing in Florida. That's one big thing I've seen in these 40-some years.
Well, again, Tony, congratulations. Tony Pipitone is South Florida investigative reporter, and Hatzel Vela is politics reporter for the local NBC 6 Investigates team. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, what Bad Bunny was telling you about Puerto Rico in his Super Bowl halftime show. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Bad Bunny's electric and widely applauded Super Bowl halftime show last Sunday was actually a sweeping narrative. It used reggaeton and salsa to tell the rich story of Bad Bunny's home, Puerto Rico, and by extension, Latin America. For many of Bad Bunny's fellow Puerto Ricans, who've confronted one crisis after another in their U.S. island territory in the past decade, his program felt like a much-needed shot of recognition and self-esteem. But a lot of viewers, especially the non-Spanish-speaking audience, wondered what was the meaning of all those images and symbols the Super Bowl show presented. Why were folks climbing rickety electric utility poles? What the heck is a piragua? And why did the flag Bad Bunny carried use a light and dark shade of blue? This wasn't just a Super Bowl spectacular. It was an important civics lesson, especially for Florida, where more than a million Puerto Ricans reside. So joining me now to discuss what Bad Bunny was telling us about Puerto Rico and why it matters is Maruxa Cardenas. She's a board member of the Puerto Rican advocacy nonprofit La Mesa Boricua in Miami. Maruxa, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tim. Thank you for having me on your show today.
We'd also like to hear your thoughts about Puerto Rico and Bad Bunny's Super Bowl show. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You know, Maruxa, why don't we just start here with the name of your organization, La Mesa Boricua, or Boricua Board, and that term, Boricua. Remind folks what that means.
Okay, La Mesa Boricua, like you said, is a nonprofit organization that we're just highlighting and working with the Puerto Rican community in the state of Florida, bringing unity and power, just creating it and fertilizing it into a big power community in South Florida and in Florida as a whole.
Okay.
Boricua for us is the original, Borinquen was the original name, or Borinque. It was the original Taino name for our island, Puerto Rico.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, so Boricuas are the people that live on that island.
Right. And we should remind people, Puerto Ricans, both on the island and on the U.S. mainland, are U.S. citizens, although those on the island cannot vote in U.S. elections. But back to the Super Bowl show, Maruxa, you mentioned to me earlier this week that you personally were emotionally overwhelmed, as you put it, as a Puerto Rican, watching the parade of symbolism in Bad Bunny's show. What were the one or two examples of that symbolism that stood out for you most, especially as a Puerto Rican who I know has lived both on the island and here in the diaspora?
Yes. The most important one, and you mentioned in your introduction, was the flag colors. It's very important to know that when we were invaded by the United States, when we were a colony of Spain, and U.S. took over Puerto Rico, they silenced our flag. Mm-hmm. They silenced our language, and they silenced our identity and our culture.
Right. And this flag, this goes back even further to 1868, when the so-called Grito de Lares, right, when that was the first revolt of Puerto Ricans against Spanish rule, no?
Yes, that's true. That was the first one that Eugenio María de Hostos led it.
Right. And that produced its own flag, right?
Yes. It produced its own flag that it's similar to the Dominican Republic, but with the light blue color, that turquoise color.
Right. And after becoming a territory, then the color went more dark blue, right?
Yes. After becoming under U.S. rule in the 1950s, when we got back our so-called constitution and so-called our own independent government, so-called, right? Because we're not. We got then the United States approved that we should use the Puerto Rican flag, but with the same shade of blue as the United States, not the previous blue that we were using before the invention.
Okay. But the flag that Bad Bunny was carrying was a lighter shade of blue, which denotes what was then brought out in the 1990s, no?
Correct.
Okay.
It was,
But this is also important because those shades of blue in the Puerto Rican flag also have to do with where a Puerto Rican might stand on the longstanding issue of whether the island should remain a U.S. territory, become a U.S. state, or become an independent country, no?
Some people might view it like that, especially the pro-statehood, but in reality, it's our original flag. So it's our original identity. Depending on what your spectrum of politics in Puerto Rico is, this is your identity.
Okay. Now, how important was it, though, Maruxa, to see that rich profile of Puerto Rico presented on one of the world's largest stages? I mean, it's estimated almost 125 million people in the U.S. and abroad were watching.
Oh, I thought it was the most amazing thing that's ever happened to the Puerto Rican at itself, our history, to get our voices know that this is an island that belongs to the United States, and this has been happening all through 120 years under the U.S. rule.
Mm-hmm. Now, having often reported in Puerto Rico myself, one of the most striking images I saw was those, as I mentioned, electric utility poles dancers were climbing while Bad Bunny's song Apagón, or Blackout, was being performed. It was a symbol of protest about Puerto Rico's chronically dysfunctional power grid, the constant blackouts, and the long history of corruption behind it all. In fact, right after the Super Bowl, Luma Energy, the private firm that now oversees Puerto Rico's electrical infrastructure, felt compelled to complain publicly about how Bad Bunny was portraying them. What does that particular problem, Maruxa, say about Puerto Rico's larger problems, in your view?
Yeah, he did, just a little bit of context, he did that song, Apagón, into a short documentary film of that song, explaining how we got to this Luma contract and to this situation. So that was like a big protest of him in making that song and writing that song and doing the documentary that he did. The Luma contract, when it happened, it was for them to control and manage our electric grid and fix it. They came in as their narrative for the press was that they were coming in to fix and repair and have us in short time, no later than a year or a year and a half, with an excellent electric service, which this contract started, I believe, in 2021. And now we're in 2026, and we're still having outages.
Still having the blackouts, right, yeah.
Yes, we just had a major year ago, but we had a major blackout that took us almost a week of people not having power.
Right.
And also thinking that most of our water supplies depend on energy.
Right, to pump.
And electric power to move our water system across the island.
Right.
So, and our water pumps. So if the energy goes out, if the electric power goes out, same as your water eventually will go out.
Right.
And if it's raining real hard, you're going to get a lot of floating because the pump system is not going to work.
Right. So as I said, it's a longstanding problem there that reflects, as I said, some of the larger problems that the island is trying to work out. And as for the record, I should say LUMA Energy in its complaint insisted that it is making advances in repairing and updating Puerto Rico's electrical infrastructure. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Maruxa Cardenas of La Mesa Boricua about what Bad Bunny was telling us about Puerto Rico in his electrifying Super Bowl halftime show. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Maruxa, let's look at some of the more joyful facets of Puerto Rico's history and culture that Bad Bunny's spectacular showcased for a world audience, whether it was the little things like the flavored ice treats called piraguas or the big things like the fact that Puerto Rico gave us one of the world's most popular and elegant music genres, salsa. Tell us about the joyful things you saw there.
Yeah, the most joyful thing was, they were like a mix. I mean, it was the first thing after coming out of the sugarcane fields was like the joy of being Puerto Rican, of enjoying, you know, a nice cold coconut when you come out of the beach or when you're coming out of work. You can get from a small vendor a nice water, coconut water, mm-hmm. just freshly.
Yep.
The piraguas is something, it's like a flavor ice. You know, like mm-hmm. Italian ice.
Yeah, like a shaved ice, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like a shaved ice. And it's a tradition of us of always having piraguas in all the street corners because it's so hot in the island, as you know. It's a Caribbean island, so we like to refresh. So we have in a small treat, you know, shaved ice with some flavor. Mm-hmm. And the small vendors, you know, the
right.
food trucks, the people that are making a living, the small, you know, that they have been reinventing themselves because of our economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those are the small vendors. Those are the food vendors that sell, you know, that sell piraguas and they sell tacos and they do your nails and everything else. But besides that, it also mentions something very big. It mentioned how women, Puerto Rico's houses are constructed on cement blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And he portrayed women construction workers putting up cement blocks. The women represent the foundation of every Puerto Rican family. They're the ones that take care of the kids. They're the ones that make sure everyone is fed, everybody's going to school, everybody's online, everybody's taken care of, everybody has food on their table, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The woman, the matriarch of the Puerto Rican family is very strong,
mm-hmm.
and he presented that.
No, you're right, that is very important. Do Puerto Ricans, though, see Bad Bunny's Super Bowl halftime show also as a corrective to all the negative imagery we've seen from the island over the past decade, not just the blackouts, but the general economic crisis that has forced so many Puerto Ricans on the island to come to the United States, or that moment, let's say, when President Trump rather disrespectfully tossed paper towels at hurricane victims in 2017, or that joke told at his 2024 campaign rally when a comic called Puerto Rico a, quote, floating island of garbage. What is the real Puerto Rico that you feel the Bad Bunny Super Bowl show got people thinking about instead?
Yes, he got us thinking in a positive image that we're joyful, that we're here, that we're hardworking people, and that we care about each other, that we care about our brothers and sisters across the Caribbean and across the Latin America, not just, you know, all the Latin Americas that are in the continent of the Americas,
mm-hmm.
that we care about each other, that we care about our migrant brothers and sisters, because right. we do. When a Dominican comes into the beach in Ayola, then people come and defend them so they don't get taken away.
Right. And just really quickly then, Maruxa, there has been a lot of talk about whether Bad Bunny himself favors independence for Puerto Rico. Do you think maybe some of this was an expression of that feeling that maybe Puerto Rico should be independent?
I don't know how he thinks, but what I have seen him portrayed is that he wants Puerto Rico to be self-determined. You know what I
that's,
mean?
That's probably the best word. Maruxa, unfortunately, we have to leave it there for time.
Okay.
Maruxa Cardenas is a board member of La Mesa Boricua. Maruxa, many thanks.
No, you're welcome, Tim. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Finally on the roundup, with Valentine's Day tomorrow, love is in the air. That is, romantic love and platonic love. As we prepare for the holiday, WLRN asked people in South Florida to share their stories of finding love or just forming genuine friendships, which experts tell us is especially hard these days for men. Here is what one of them, Robert Lyle from Lauderdale-by-the-Sea, had to say about his best friend, Jim. They met on an online support group for loved ones with dementia. Later, they realized their wives were in the same memory care facility.
I've never had a close friendship my entire life like I have with Jim. It's just, it works. We could talk and understand what we were talking about and what we were feeling without focusing on only dealing with our wives. It was the purpose of two guys getting together and being friends. And that's what counted, was being friends, having a friend.
To hear more stories like Robert and Jim's, visit WLRN.org. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.